I want to apologize for something to you and the world.
For existing?
Really? No. For the you know how I always make fun of you for cutting stickers like a, I don't know.
Maybe restart this.
Like someone who can't cut stickers.
Stop.
These are so, we spent the weekend making a new batch of stickers. We're working on a project, like a little special something for Tanya Brown on the side. But we're also cutting new stickers for everybody. And it is hard. It is hard
it
to
is
cut
so hard.
When you don't, when they're not cut by the Cricut and you have to cut them by hand, my circles are like I forget for whoever gets these stickers.
They're going to be like, well, that's a weird shape I've never seen before.
I know. Well, I take it back is what I'm saying. So I'm going to be the bigger person and apologize.
Wow. There's a first time for everything.
I'm maturing.
It's Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
What is up, crime crew? Welcome back to another episode of Murder Unscripted, the podcast that immerses you in the true crime genre like never before. You're just tuning in for the first time. I'm your host, Ed Hydock, along with my partner in true crime, the sassy sleuth, Melissa Spivey.
Oh, I like that. I'm going to put that on my business card. It's like, just cross out my actual title at work and put sassy sleuth.
I like it. I'm on board.
Right? All right. I'm doing it tomorrow.
Well, Melissa, it is the final Tuesday of the month, which means we're closing out our block 10, month 10. Like, I can't believe that, first of all. But
no, me neither.
We have dedicated March to the month of madness. So March Madness, basically discussing high profile crimes in the world of sports. In week one, you had shared the case of professional bodybuilder Ray McNeil, who was killed by his shotgun wielding bodybuilding wife, Sally. Killer Sally.
Killer
McNeil.
Sally.
Yeah. And then in week two, I told you about the murder of, it was more about the life and times of Nicole Brown Simpson. Mm-hmm. And then in week three, man, we had the absolute privilege of talking to her baby sister, Tanya Brown. What a great interview.
Oh my God, I'm obsessed with her. She was so real and just so kind and down to earth. And, you know, one thing we didn't get to mention when we talked to her was a quote that she shared with us. And it was a piece of advice that Nicole had actually given to Tanya when Tanya was in college, and she was just going through a particularly hard time between college and the loss of a couple of friends and some other things going on. And Nicole told her, quote, "Delete the need to understand. Some things just are," end quote. And the more I think about this quote, it is such a brilliant piece of advice. Like, it's so simple, but it's so impactful.
I completely agree. And I feel like if more people adopted that mentality, it would just help people get over problems, you know, like a lot quicker. Some things you simply can't change in this world. So build a bridge, get over it, and move on. I don't know.
100%.
Well, Melissa, let's get into our case for today. Are you ready?
Yes. Well, actually, no. Real quick, friendly reminder. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe, and hit that cute little notification bell so you don't miss out on new episodes of Murder Unscripted. And now, I'm ready. You may proceed.
Oh, thank you. Well, this is a case that I'm going to tell you today that absolutely shook the college sports world because of just the senselessness of it. I mean, they're all senseless, but at least some of them, there's a motive that you can, like, at least I kind of understand why he did it. Not that I agree with it, but it makes sense. This one is just completely like, what? So we will be discussing the events surrounding the case of Patrick Dennehy. And this is an absolutely wild story because it exposed some serious issues within Baylor University's basketball program. And it led to a humongous scandal and a deep investigation after numerous egregious attempts to cover things up. And this one pisses me off because it doesn't stem from some like recruiting violation or some kid got a DUI and we have to protect him, right? This is about a person's life, Patrick's life, to be exact. So in order to set the stage and kind of give you a feel for the time and place that we're talking about and basically add a little levity to this otherwise very serious conversation, we'll need to pull the rain cover off the old time machine, Melissa, and set it to 2003, Waco, Texas, the home of Dr. Pepper and the Texas Rangers.
Oh, man, the time machine. I don't even know if it works. I haven't used it in forever. Hopefully it's got its good sound effects that everyone loves so much.
Oh, I doubt
beep
it.
Beep, beep, beep. Well, let's talk about Waco, Texas. So this is like a small, kind of laid-back city, but it has a really rich mix of culture, history, and attractions. It's famous for Baylor University, which is one of the oldest schools and like largest employers in Texas, but there's also a haunting vibe from its past. So just 10 miles from Baylor's campus, the ghosts of the 1993 standoff just are lingering around. The Waco Siege, which is also known as the Waco Massacre, it was a tense 51-day standoff involving the federal government and Texas law enforcement against the notorious cult led by David Koresh.
I forgot how many days it was. 51 days. Think about that. That's a long-ass time.
Obviously, this event left like a huge mark on the city, but it was also a time when folks were looking towards brighter days. And the early 2000s was definitely a period of transformation, not only for Waco, Texas, but I think for the world. Actually, 2003 in particular was a huge year for technology. That was the year that camera phones really took off. I didn't know that. I thought they were earlier than that, but that's the year that like almost all models started coming out. Like it became standard on cell phones. The third generation iPod was released along with iTunes. And MySpace debuted on August 1st, 2003. But in regard to music, Beyoncé dropped her solo album, Dangerously in Love. Outkast was shaking it like a Polaroid picture with Hey Ya. And Fountains of Wayne made sure everybody knew that Stacey's mom had it going on. And 2003 was the year we were reminded to keep on swimming with the release of Finding Nemo.
That was the year I actually graduated college, and that's a good transition to this story because I remember those days like they were yesterday, and I feel like you were just living in the moment at the time. You know, it was your first taste of freedom. You had no parents to answer to. You could eat what you want. You could do what you want. You could make your own mistakes, which I think is as important as doing the right thing. Like screwing up, I feel like sets the tone for other things in your life and how you handle it. And like some of the wild college parties and just crowded dance floors, $2 drink specials, you know, everywhere you go, these dingy basements and the occupancy was like 250 and you had 700 people crammed in there.
The walk of shame the next morning, mascara down your face, your heels in your hand. I get it.
I think we live different experiences. Well, I remember homecomings and basketball games being an absolute blast, and that was at a D3 school. So, I mean, I can't even imagine what they were like at Baylor University. The excitement at the time was all about the 2002-2003 men's basketball team, which included future NBA stars or wannabe NBA stars like Patrick Dennehy. Unfortunately, the team got wrapped up in a scandal that was so big that it cost Patrick his life, I believe, and it led to some serious consequences. Everything happening behind the straight-laced private Baptist college, both on and off the court, was not as squeaky clean as it appeared. So let's dive into who Patrick Dennehy was. Born on January 28, 1982, in Santa Clara, California, Patrick Dennehy grew up with his mom, Valerie, his stepdad, Brian Brabazon, and his little sister, Wynn. And they were all super close, literally best buddies. She was always his little sidekick. When, whether he was hanging out with his friends, catching a movie, or just chilling at home watching MTV, Wynn loved being attached to her big brother. They were literally attached at the hip. And Patrick was the life of the party. He was goofy, he was caring, he was athletic, he was smart, and he was all about sports, especially baseball, basketball, skateboarding, and rollerblading. And he also loved spending time with his friends and family. And he even went to Bible study. So, I mean, this kid, he did have his head on straight, by all accounts.
And he was very well-rounded. Like, he had a lot of things going on. Yeah.
He really did. And sports were such a huge part of Patrick's life, and he played for the Santa Clara Ponyboys baseball team. But by the time he hit 13, he found a real passion for basketball, and that came naturally to him. It was noted by his stepdad, Brian. Patrick was known for his kindness and his sense of humor and always ready to make other people laugh or go the extra mile for the people he loved.
He was such a cute kid, and his childhood and teenage years just sound so wholesome. You know I love that.
Yeah, well, wholesome is a great way to describe Patrick. I mean, this kid had such a clear sense of self and a vision for the future. And he started out playing baseball, as I had mentioned, but his dream was to make it big in the NBA. And by the time he hit seventh grade, this kid was towering over his classmates at 6'3" already in seventh grade.
Wow.
There is this awesome picture of Patrick's baseball. You know how everyone takes the team photos at the beginning of the year? So it's this great picture that they're the Indians all across their chest. But then Patrick is literally like a foot taller than everybody else on the team.
Aww.
Well, this kid was laser focused on achieving his goals. His coaches pushed him to hone his skills and improve. And he spent countless hours in the gym, just on the court. And even on days when he was feeling stressed, he would shoot around or do a workout or to kind of cope with what he was dealing with. It was his outlet. So eventually this quiet kid, he was seen as a loner, just kind of kept to himself, but he grew to a towering 6'9" by high school. And it like,
holy shit, 6'9"?
It's hard
That's insane, hard
to be introverted when you're 6'9".
Oh my God. How tall are you?
For reference, I am 5'9". So a foot taller than me.
So a ruler on top of your head. I got
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
What did we say the other day? Americans will use anything but the metric system.
Yeah, exactly. Like, how much are you? I'm an Ed Hydock and a ruler tall. So Patrick soon found himself playing for the University of New Mexico, the Lobos, for 2 years. And unfortunately, he was dismissed from the team after an incident during a game against Air Force. And then ultimately, he ended up walking out of practice. Basically, it wasn't a good fit for Patrick in New Mexico. And due to college basketball rules, Patrick had to sit out an entire year then before regaining his eligibility because of what had happened at New Mexico.
Wow.
So by 2002, Patrick was ready for a fresh start, and he relocated to Waco, Texas, and enrolled at Baylor. And he was so excited for his first season where he'd get to face off against some real opponents. Some Big 12 conference had some great basketball teams back then. And it was a chance to really like showcase his skills and turn things around and erase the things that happened in New Mexico. And his coach, Dave Bliss, really pumped him up about being one of their scholarship athletes with his support. He assured Patrick that if he chose Baylor, he wouldn't have to stress out about a thing. And Patrick was kind of relieved to know that he'd have a free education, a place to stay. And he even mentioned to his mom that Coach Bliss helped him score a car. And jumping into college sports came with its own set of challenges and kind of building relationship with his new teammates like Carlton Dotson, who would play a big role in this story. Let's talk about Carlton Dotson. So Carlton was a junior power forward and a friend of Patrick, who went to North Dorchester High School in Hurlock, Maryland. He then moved on to Paris Junior College before transferring to Baylor in the summer of 2002, right after he split up with his estranged wife. So in April of 2003, Carlton and Patrick were placed in student housing together along with two other players, and he and Carlton immediately hit it off. They were like brothers to the point where you rarely would see one without the other. And I want to talk about some of these other people that were in this house with him. So Harvey Thomas, he was the new kid on the block, a junior college transfer from Northeastern Oklahoma. And Patrick was assigned as his chaperone to kind of show him the ropes. And Patrick picked up Harvey from the airport and they hit it off right away. Coach Bliss told Harvey that he could crash at Patrick's place until his apartment was ready. So there were a bunch of guys in this place. Only four of them belonged there, but Harvey was staying for a while too. So they obviously all started to kind of establish this bond. And Harvey slept on the couch while Dotson had his room in the back with their other roommate, Chris Turk. And once Harvey settled in, he called upon his cousin, Larry Johnson, who was known as the sidekick, just someone who basically tagged along with everything. And Larry hopped on a Greyhound and made his way to Waco to hang out with his pair to see what life on campus was like.
First of all, the sidekick that just kind of hung around, is that like me on yours and Brenda's dates?
100%. It's not even dates. It's like when we take our family places, it's like, and Melissa. Melissa, we're going to the zoo. You got to buy your own ticket though.
Anyway, back to the case. All right. I'm seeing some red flags and they are waving. First of all, that saying three's a crowd seems relevant, not with us and Brenda, but with Patrick and Carlton.
Yes, yes.
Because they were besties. And then Harvey kind of like coming into that friendship, I feel like, especially if Patrick and him clicked really well, like after Patrick and Carlton had just clicked.
Mm-hmm.
And second of all, these young men are living together and practicing together and playing together and traveling to other places together. And no matter how much you might like each other, that is a lot of time to be spending together, especially when you consider this is the first time that these young men have probably lived with people who weren't their family. So that certainly is an adjustment when you see how other people live. And also, I don't love that Harvey is just like inviting people to someone else's apartment.
Isn't that weird?
Like, yeah. Harvey, you don't live here, bro.
Those red flags are whipping like a Texas tornado.
I told you.
Well, and you might be right, because it turns out their relationship was way more complicated than anyone thought. There was this hidden tension that kind of caught everyone off guard. So soon, whispers about Dotson's mental health started to circulate. And things became rocky between he and Harvey, with Dotson kind of growing more paranoid. And Patrick's best friend, Daniel Okopny, was quoted as saying that he got a frantic call one day from Patrick. Daniel had never heard such fear in Patrick's voice. And Patrick hinted that something was wrong and that they needed to talk in person, which was very unusual for him. And he confided during this conversation that he was being threatened, but so was Dotson. Like, there were people that were after them. And Patrick never really revealed the specifics of those threats, but he told Daniel that they needed help. And Patrick also shared his worries about the new transfer, Harvey Thomas, with his then-girlfriend, Jessica Marlowe. And Jessica urged him to reach out for help and inform the coaches. And that's exactly what Patrick did. On June 9th, 2003, Patrick approached his assistant coach, Abar Rouse, expressing that he and Dotson were being threatened by Larry Johnson and Harvey Thomas, adding that if Rouse knew the details about kind of what they were being threatened, like the nature of the threats, he'd be scared too.
So are Larry Johnson and Harvey Thomas the one making the calls? Like, do we know who was making the threatening phone calls? Was it them or was it someone else, like, on their behalf?
We're not really sure, you know, like, I don't know if Patrick ever really truly revealed the details. And I know his family doesn't really know either. And the one thing that's clear, though, is by this point, both Patrick and Carlton Dotson were genuinely afraid for their safety. So on June 7th, 2003, they made the decision to buy guns for protection. And now you got college kids with guns.
Yikes. And I don't think that they were probably even allowed to have firearms on campus. You said they were in student housing. And I feel like firearms are prohibited on the majority, if not all, of college campuses.
You would be correct. Yeah, they're obviously legal to open carry in Texas, but you cannot be in possession of one on campus.
Also, I feel like they should have taken this stuff straight to the police, not their coaches.
I know. But I mean, you don't want to be labeled a snitch. You don't want to be a you know what I mean? You start going, there's people after me, like.
Yeah, I get that. I just feel like if you're genuinely that scared, you got to do something. But I get not wanting to go because that makes it so real. It's just like calling 911 if you have like a missing person. It's like that call makes it so real. Up until then, you can pretend they're going to walk in the door. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, exactly right. I get it. Well, and Daniel Okopny had mentioned that he had never seen Patrick handle a gun or even own one. So, I mean, this was a recipe for disaster. And Chris Turk, their other roommate, is pretty shaken to find now a bunch of Harvey shows up and now there's all these guns. So kind of rattled him a little bit. So there's one particularly scary moment that Chris Turk remembers when he was home alone and he heard a knock at the door. and he peeked through the peephole, but he couldn't see who was out there. He had a gut feeling it was Harvey, but he described the figure as a tall African-American man, about 6'5 or more, brandishing a handgun in kind of a menacing way. So nothing really becomes of this, but a few days later, Patrick was talking to Daniel on the phone because it was Daniel's birthday and they were planning a party down at Daniel's place. So Daniel invited Patrick and Carlton Dotson to kind of come celebrate, stay the night. They'd go out, party, have fun. And Patrick and Dotson were all about it. And they figured they'd report the incident about the gun-toting man at the door to police when they got back. They were just going to go down, hang for the maybe 24 or 36 hours and come back. So the trouble is, though, they never showed up to the party. And that's where the wheels fall off of this whole thing. So on Friday the 13th, Abar Rouse, he was that assistant coach I had mentioned, he noticed that Patrick was missing from class. And this is the day after he had talked to Daniel on the phone. And one of the roles of an assistant coach is to kind of keep track of the players to ensure they're getting to their classes, they're getting to their destinations. So this whole thing about them not showing up to the party and then not showing up to class, it kind of started to raise some suspicions around the team. And initially, the coaches thought Patrick might have just taken off for the weekend a bit early. But on June 15th, 2003, his stepdad, Brian Brabazon, and his mom, Valerie, started to get this anxious feeling because it was Father's Day and Patrick hadn't called. And this was something he always would do. This kid was so good and responsible and just good to his parents. And he would always make it a point to call or like send a card for special occasions. So Brian figured he'd get a call from Patrick on Monday. But when that didn't happen, the worry started to grow. And then by Tuesday, the coaching staff, including Abar Rouse, was really starting to get worried. This was now a problem. So Patrick's girlfriend, Jessica Marlowe, was also unable to reach him. And she had contacted Carlton Dotson, who claimed he really had no idea where Patrick was. He expressed his fear that they're getting these threats. There's this guy showing up wielding a gun at the door, you know, so it could possibly Harvey. So they're obviously feeling really nervous. And Carlton revealed that he had gone at this point to Maryland. He went home and Patrick planned to just stay at Baylor, but he had no idea where Patrick was. This whole party thing fell apart and they just kind of did their own thing. So Brian Brabazon, Patrick's stepdad, also reached out to Carlton Dotson, and Carlton was like, things are crazy, like we have to get out of here, and that if he can ever talk to him in person, he would. But things are so unsafe right now that he's just kind of looking over his shoulder and watching out for his own. So shady stuff going on Carlton's part, if you ask me.
Yeah.
So Patrick's stepfather then reached out to Coach Bliss, who casually dismissed his concern, suggesting that Patrick was simply hanging out with friends. And Abar Rouse, the assistant coach, remembers going by Patrick's house looking for his vehicle over that weekend, and he couldn't find it. So obviously, everybody's growing increasingly alarmed at this point, and Patrick's best friend, Daniel, enlisted a buddy, and they drove to Baylor. They're in Maryland. That's this whole thing. It's all making sense.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
So Daniel hadn't heard from Patrick since the day he was supposed to leave to come for his birthday party. And once Daniel arrived and he saw the property manager, they basically had to let him into Patrick's apartment. And when they opened the door, there was a smell that just smacked him in the face. And it was two baby pit bulls that were new dogs for Patrick. They were left unattended. And after feeding the dog, that was like priority number one, went into Patrick's room where he found this half-packed suitcase on the bed and no sign of Patrick. So Daniel left a note indicating that he was there. He had taken the dogs. But he was still like kind of puzzled by this half-packed bag and like Patrick's absence and where was he? Where was he going? And ultimately, by June 19th, so this is about a little over a week after he was last heard from, Patrick's dad, Brian Brabazon, decided to call the Waco police and file a missing persons report.
Okay, well, I don't know this case very well, but I'm going to say Daniel didn't do it because he rescued the little pit bull puppies. So he's a good guy in my book.
A good dude.
Good dude.
His priorities straight. So on June 23rd, 2003, Detective Bob Fuller meets up with Coach Bliss, and the coaches were interested in being present during these player interviews that the police wanted to do to find out more about Patrick and where he might be. But the detective didn't think that was a good idea because when coaches, it's like having your boss there when you're trying to do your job. Like it's just people looking over your shoulders. They're like, maybe could influence the answers they provide.
These kids are legally adults. They don't need their weird-ass coach, who I feel like is shady as shit, sitting there.
You are going to find out just how shady Coach Bliss really
is.
We're just cracking the surface. And it I don't know, immediately makes you think that they're going to be coached. Coach, see what I did there?
Yeah, but I'm
like, you know what I mean? Like to spin this into some kind of narrative.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whatever the case, while conducting these interviews, Detective Fuller learns that Harvey Thomas, Patrick, and another guy thought to be Larry Johnson were all living together in this place off student housing. And Dotson had some cash that had gone missing, and everyone is convinced that Harvey Thomas was the person who took it. And this all happened on June 6th, so about a week and a half-ish before Patrick's disappearance. And Abar, the assistant coach, mentioned that Carlton and Patrick came into the office claiming that Larry Johnson and Harvey had threatened them with a gun. And one of them even mimicked kind of putting a gun to his head. So who knows what was really going on, but I do believe that Harvey Thomas and this Larry Johnson guy were behind a lot of these threats.
Yeah.
So around this time is when Patrick and Carlton decided to buy guns for their safety. And they had approached some assistant coaches about, they were looking for guidance about kind of what they should do. Should they report this to the police? And basically they were told to keep it internal because Baylor didn't want this kind of publicity. However, they were aware of Harvey Thomas making threats and they said they were taking steps to address it with him, which whether they were or not, when they talked to Coach Bliss about the situation, Bliss claimed to have no clue what was going on. And that the last time he saw Patrick, it had been on June 12th, 2003. And Coach Bliss also kind of claims that he doesn't know about any issues between Patrick or any other teammate. Like he was completely oblivious to all this.
That's some bullshit. He wants to be there for their police interviews. He's setting up people to live together. Like you can't tell me, like you're so involved in these students' lives. Like how can you be so out of the loop?
There's zero chance that he didn't know what was going on. He may have pretended to be, but there was no chance that he did not know what his star players were doing. And Detective Fuller spoke with the players and all the coaches. And when they speak with Harvey, he tells them the coaches did come to him regarding the threats, but he said there was no beef. And that's exactly what he tells police too. He's like, I don't know why these guys were afraid of me. Like I didn't do anything wrong. I'm not shady. I'm not creepy. I'm not pulling guns on people. I'm not stealing money. I'm not doing these things. And get this. So Harvey tells police that the coaches who had asked him about the threats, one of them was Coach Bliss. So make that make sense. Scandal loading.
I'm going to be honest. I don't particularly like college sports for this exact reason. Like, I think that the students are there to get an education. That's kind of the whole point of college. And I feel like that takes such a back seat to sporting events. I don't get it. And like, I think they do some shady ass shit to recruit these kids. Clearly, you cannot tell me that Baylor is the only one who gave some kid a Tahoe. Like,
oh, it's not.
They do shady shit to recruit the kids. The education takes a back seat to throwing a ball around a court. Like, I'm not into it. But back to Coach Bliss, he gives me a very icky feeling. Icky, icky.
He should, because to this day, Coach Bliss still denies any knowledge, and Harvey, too, vehemently denies ever threatening Patrick or stealing any money. So it's really, he said, she said, but you know.
Yeah.
So, and at this point in our story, remember, Patrick is still missing, and there hadn't been any luck finding him, and the search was at a complete standstill. Like, nobody's talking, nobody's giving up information. So what are people to do? During Detective Fuller's investigation, he was told by people that Patrick and Carlton would go out shooting. And shooting meaning like they had just gotten these guns, so they were like practicing. They're like, we've never owned guns. We need to learn how to fire them, you know? Mm-hmm. So that led police to kind of search some of these areas around Baylor just to see where would kids go to shoot guns. You know, nobody really knew. So fast forward about 2 weeks. On June 26, 2003, Patrick Dennehy's Chevy Tahoe turns up in a shopping mall parking lot in Virginia Beach, Virginia. And this is about 1,000 miles from where it should have been. And guess what? License plates are gone and there's no sign of Patrick. People's biggest fears are being realized at this point because the family knows that somebody knows something about this with how close he was with these teammates. And he lived with these guys that have all these kind of suspicious allegations surrounding him. So like, somebody knows something and they're not talking. So After the vehicle was found, McLennan County Sheriff's Detective Clay Perry heads to Virginia Beach with Detective Fuller. And what they found in the car was shocking because it was nothing. It was wiped completely clean.
So clearly someone had been in it. But you know what I think is weird? I think it's weird that they took the license plates off the car. I feel like that draws way more attention. Obviously, yeah. I'm glad that they're stupid. But, like, I feel like that would draw way more attention than just a car sitting there with the license plates. Like, it would have pushed the investigation back so much further, I feel.
You know what? And I can't speak to whether or not these ALPRs, these license plate readers that we talked about before, were being used in 03. I guarantee the technology wasn't as advanced as it is today. But, yeah, leave the plate on, because unless they can have these plate readers, they're not going to know one from the other. Because I'm sure there was an APB, but we're also about 1,000 miles from where that car should be. So
exactly.
Yeah. Well, there's a theory that might connect Harvey to the crime, and that's the fact that he was from Fredericksburg, Virginia. And the car was discovered in Virginia Beach. So it's about a 2-hour drive in between. And then there's another theory that points to Carlton Dotson's involvement. And that's the fact that he also lived about 2 hours away from where the car was found. So after they left Virginia Beach, Detectives Fuller and Perry thought it would be a good idea to basically drop by and see what Carlton Dotson has to say, since they were not that far from his house, about 2 hours away. And during the interview, Dotson had no interest in talking about Patrick whatsoever. He was only interested in talking about this alleged drug use that's going on at Baylor. And he implied that Coach Abar, the assistant coach, like, who so far is the coolest person in this entire story.
Yeah.
That he had players selling cocaine, and he had this kid named Ellis Kidd. Hold on, it's Ellis Kidd selling drugs for him, as well as Harvey. And Fuller had no interest in that. Like, Fuller doesn't care about that, the detective.
No.
His main focus is, like, where's Patrick and how do we find him? But every time Patrick's name is brought up in this interview, his whole demeanor changes. Like, there were periods in the interview where they would step out to kind of monitor Carlton Dotson from another room, and they'd hear him, like, mumbling things under his breath. And there's one point during the interview where Fuller asked Dotson what Patrick's personality was like, and he referred to Patrick in the past tense and then kind of caught himself and took a step back. So that is a sure sign. Linguistics is a huge in body language.
Oh, that is never good. That whole, like, past tense thing will get you. Mm-hmm. And I also feel like Carlton deflecting and, like, randomly bringing up these drugs that we've heard nothing about is such another telltale sign that he knows what's letting on. Or, like, he knows more than he's letting on.
That's what you do, though. Yeah, you try to change the subject. Get people away from what's making you uncomfortable. Well, Detective Fuller then asks him when the last time he saw Patrick was. And Carlton basically wanted to stop the interview. And he was free to go. I mean, you know, he wasn't under arrest. He wasn't, you know, you can just leave. And he drove to his grandmother's house. So on July 2nd, 2003, Coach Bliss brings Abar Rouse into his office and questions him about whether or not he was handing out drugs to the team. How could this even be the case when Coach Abar had only been on the job for 12 days? I feel like you're new to a job. You don't just come in and start handing out cocaine within your first 2 weeks.
No, you wait until you're there at least a month.
That's
come
a
on.
Month. Yeah. Yeah. That's
at least.
That's not new hire behavior.
No. You got to make it past your 90-day probation, actually.
Yeah. Then you start selling cocaine.
Yep.
Well, they also asked Abar if he ever coerced Patrick or Carlton and whether he would be willing to take a lie detector test. So Abar says, absolutely, and he passes with flying colors. So we know he's on the up and up.
So we know that this whole drug story is just a cover-up for someone else's misdeeds or something way bigger.
Way bigger, for sure, and we'll soon discover what that is after his girlfriend Jessica Marlowe, still worried and scared about what's happening to Patrick, she made the decision to basically self-report her own NCAA violations and also report Patrick's, because to her understanding, the NCAA worked with the FBI when necessary. So she was like, if I divulge these things that we were doing wrong, maybe they'll step in and help find him. And she believed it was pretty much the only way to get authorities involved in Patrick's case. So she told the NCAA that she and Patrick had received money on several occasions and that had received the Tahoe.
Shady ass shit.
Yes. And I know you're not a sports fan, let alone a college sports fan, but yeah, that's a no-no. So no one even realized that Patrick wasn't on a scholarship. And when that info got out, Baylor found themselves in a huge mess. Coach Bliss was caught covering up about $40,000 in tuition for Patrick and another player during the initial probe. And then to top it off, the coaching staff didn't report some failed drug tests that were going on the team. And it was history repeating itself, because this was not the first time Dave Bliss's name has been attached to a scandal. So back at SMU, which is Southern Methodist University, back in 1985, boosters were shelling out thousands to football coaches for recruits and giving them monthly payments. They had them like on the payroll. And they were like, "It won't happen again, though. Don't worry. I know we got caught, but we promise." But guess what? So Dave Bliss joined the coaching staff in 1987, just 2 years later, and investigators found out that Bliss was paying players under the table. In fact, a former player named John Konkak told investigators that during his freshman year at SMU, everybody on the basketball team was getting paid except him. He was pissed that he was the only one not getting paid. So
I get that.
Yes. So he goes to Bliss and expresses his concerns. And within 2 days, Ford Mustang shows up in his driveway. So not a lot becomes of this. And all of a sudden, Coach Bliss ends up in New Mexico right after that. So nobody really knew what happened back at SMU. And once again, Dave Bliss kind of slips through the cracks. And if you remember, New Mexico is where Patrick was recruited first to come play at Baylor. That's where he had all those problems and then ended up going to Baylor. So there's the connection.
Yeah. This is insane. And like, this is what I'm saying about being shady. Like, how does this dude keep dodging the consequences? Like, I have such disdain for people like this. And let's be honest, we know that this shit is happening at colleges all over the country.
It's a fact. And it's, I mean, you just read the news. It happens. Every couple of years is a major scandal. And it's starting to, things are turning around though, because they're starting to actually pay some of these athletes because they're bringing in so much money for the schools, you know?
Yeah. Cause they're at school where they're supposed to be getting an education. Like, this blows me away that this is such a big deal.
You don't have to go to college to go to the NBA or go to the NFL, but you want to go showcase your skills at the next level. And then, you know what, cause that leads to then you get picked higher in the draft. Bigger draft, you know what I mean? You get a better chance to prove yourself, but that means going to class too and getting decent grades. So like, a lot of these athletes aren't the smartest cookies. Some are, but you know, they're just there to play sports. And I feel like the same shit happens with Catholic priests. They just keep kind of moving them around from town to town. Like, they get busted here doing something they're not supposed to. And all of a sudden they turn out in Seattle, Washington, like some, you know, and it sucks because Catholic priest, basketball coach, whatever, this is impacting young lives and futures. And I mean, this guy has more lives than a cat at this point, this Dave Bliss. And it's unbelievable how he always seems to escape any serious repercussions. And he was meant to be a mentor, someone that these kids could rely on. But his actions tell a much more troubling story. So while the circumstances surrounding Patrick's death are still haunting, there's a piece of the story that's more disturbing. So let's talk about someone much closer to this tragedy, and that's his friend Carlton Dotson. Because his involvement brings up a lot of complicated questions.
I feel like Carlton and Patrick had a very unusual relationship. Like, when I was going through sources, some people claim that they were like brothers, the closest friends at Baylor, BFFs for real. Well, others thought Dotson was just kind of like jealous of Patrick, like jealous of his background and jealous of his sports, that he was good at it.
Prowess.
What is that called?
His prowess.
Prowess. Yeah, whatever. Jealous sports of his skills. Prowess, his sports stuff and his background. And it just seems like a lot of people liked Patrick. Like, they were drawn to him. And like, Carlton, I wasn't getting that vibe about him.
Well, and their relationship dynamic kind of seems to change depending who you talk to, because it seems like Carlton, he allegedly had a bit of a troubled past and was dealing with these mental health challenges, and that might have contributed to his feelings of jealousy and resentment and his own insecurities.
God, we have been like, insecurity is like the theme of this month. Like, Sally and Ray were both so insecure and like felt inferior about everything.
Yep.
OJ was inferior in every way, but like, he also felt that. Like,
I feel like it's going to turn up though in a lot of these cases, because people who aren't wired right take these insecurities and turn them into something really violent.
Yeah. Well, and all the competition leads to so much like competition. Like, and then they compete against It's not just like, I feel like on the court sometimes it like goes off into regular life, which again brings us back to like living together, playing together, being friends. Mm-hmm. Like that's just a lot to constantly compare yourself to someone.
That's a really good point. It's true. Well, let's get into the details of Carlton's role. And this is from one of the investigators on the case. So on July 17th, 2003, Patrick at this point had been missing for 28 days. And FBI Special Agent Timothy Sponogle got a call saying that Dotson wanted to talk. So Carlton calls him and says he wants to talk. And during this interview, he requested that the FBI come pick him up. He begins by saying these really weird things like demonic spirits were after him. And there were these things that took place that he can't explain. And he says people had been trying to take him out ever since he'd been in Waco. So again, he's talking about these threats. He asked if he wants to talk to Waco police, and he said no, very sternly, but then just started like talking about this higher power and laughing, this maniacal laugh. And it was just really sinister and weird. And he goes on to say that his family is a family of prophets, and that he is a bigger prophet and all men sin. And when asked if he wanted to discuss the disappearance of his roommate, Patrick Dennehy, he ended the interview, and then he was picked up by his former high school coach. So the family grew obviously very concerned about his mental state, and he was exhibiting some very odd behaviors.
Mr. Carlton Dotson, do you understand that you're being recorded?
Yes.
Why do you want us to come pick you up? What did you come here to tell us?
There are many, many demonic spirits that are after me. There are things taking place that are unexplainable. My faith is so strong, I have been taken over by a higher power. My family is a family of prophets.
You believe yourself to be a prophet?
I'm much more than that.
Something bothering you, Carlton?
All men should sin, but there is time to repent. Time to repent.
Are you trying to do that now?
I have already been forgiven for any sin I may commit.
Yes. Is there something you want to tell us about the disappearance of your roommate?
No, that's it.
So not long after this interview, Dotson was having a chat with his high school coach, and he suggested that if anything's bothering you, you should talk to somebody. So all of a sudden, then shortly after that conversation, Carlton calls 911 and tells the dispatcher he again wants to talk to the FBI. So they arrange a meetup at this hotel. During this interview, Dotson shares how he and Patrick had planned a shooting trip, basically practice shooting, and because remember, people had been threatening them. So they drove to this remote area for some target practice, and Dotson had a 9mm while Patrick was using a 32 caliber. And Dotson then claimed that Patrick pointed the 32 at him and pulled the trigger, but it didn't go off. It either jammed or something happened, which right there, it's a little weird because why would he just do that? Why would Patrick Dennehy, the nicest dude in the world, just turn a gun on his friend and pull a trigger? Come on.
Lies.
So when he tried to reload, two bullets fell out. At that moment, Dotson feared for his life, and he said, "Father, please forgive me." And he pulled at the trigger of his gun and shot Patrick in the head.
Oh, God.
So after that, Carlton said he jumped into the truck, went back to their apartment, changed his clothes, threw him in a dumpster, and drove to Dallas. And on the way, he got rid of the gun in a lake before continuing his journey.
Wow.
And a key part of the interview was trying to figure out where Patrick's body was. And they give Carlton this map and kind of say, pinpoint the area where this all happened. And while this is happening, an arrest warrant is also issued for Carlton Dotson. And he was arrested on July 21st, 2003. And after the arrest, the McClellan County DA, John Segrist, got involved. And he had no evidence beyond Carlton's statement that a murder had occurred. Obviously, they still had no body, which is something that they preferred to have before they went to court, because we've talked no bodies since day one of this podcast, and it's very difficult. It can be done, but it's a lot easier if you have a body.
Absolutely.
So Detective Bob Fuller goes out for a second search to some of these areas. And remember, Dotson's using these maps now to kind of pinpoint where things are. And he's hit by this enormous smell of decomposition in this field not far from Baylor. and he finds this box of ammunition in the weeds. And there's a thorough search of the area the next day. And Clay Perry, one of the other detectives, arrives at the scene and also caught a whiff of this awful smell, this putrid decomposition. And there was the badly decomposed body of Patrick Dennehy. And this is kind of messed up because when his body was discovered, Patrick's head was in a different spot. And that led to reports that he had been decapitated. So all of a sudden now these reports start circulating and you start to think like there was something really crazy. Like, could this be gang related? Could be, you know, you have that adds an element of a violent element to this that wasn't there before.
Do you think, or did they think, that maybe the head was removed to try and conceal the identity?
Well, I can tell you that at the end of all this, police do think that the head was removed by animals because he had been out there for a month. So I think the evidence pointed that that's what actually happened. And whatever the case, Patrick was later identified through dental records. And an autopsy at Southwestern Institute of Forensic Sciences in Dallas revealed Patrick had been shot twice above the right ear. And the first was toward the back of his head and the other was toward the front. And the first bullet exited Dennehy's forehead above his left eye. So out this way. And the second bullet exited behind his left ear. So it was all kind of on this side.
Yeah.
And here's the part that proves everything we were just talking about. So this is a college kid, right? Who apparently sells cocaine on the side and does all these awful things. But the tox screens showed absolutely zero in Patrick's body. There's no drugs, no alcohol, no marijuana, nothing. So he was a good kid.
Mm-hmm.
And in the wake of this discovery, authorities learned that Carlton Dotson had reached out to his estranged wife, Melissa Kethley, just hours before he allegedly shot his Baylor teammate. And according to ESPN. So she recounted finding Dotson in a video store parking lot where he was sitting in Dennehy's black Chevy Tahoe. And he was like, I want to talk. So she didn't really think anything of it at the time, but during that conversation, Dotson said he wanted to reconcile and he expressed remorse for his past actions and he claimed that he changed and they wanted to get back together. But he got real nervous and basically urged Kethley not to don't like use her phone or inform anyone about the meeting. So like telling someone not to use their phone is like, okay, you don't want it pinged. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I would literally get my phone out and immediately start texting.
Yeah, something just because that's shady. But
that's so shady. Yes.
So afterward, he drove Melissa Kethley to a motel and asked her to stay the night, but she refused, which sparked a huge argument. So she got out of the car, slammed the door and walked a half mile in the rain to her own car. And that was the last time they would actually see each other in person before this murder investigation into Patrick Dennehy's death.
Wow.
So in an interview with the Associated Press at our college campus about 70 miles east of Dallas, Melissa Kethley shares how Dotson's behavior shifted in the months following their marriage. She mentioned that he accused her of infidelity with his teammates. He physically assaulted her. He claimed to hear these voices. So this may have been something that was kind of festering. She said in the AP, quote, "It was like he had become a completely different person. His expressions, his tone, it terrified me," end quote. So on July 21st, 2003, 32 days after Patrick was missing, Dotson was arrested for the murder of Patrick Dennehy.
You know what I'm wondering? She just said that his tone changed and they were talking about it like his laugh in the one interview was like maniacal and sinister. I wonder if the threats that Patrick was getting was like him in another voice.
Oh, that's interesting. This is a Dr. Buzz. Like, we need Buzz. Get Buzz on the phone.
We need Buzz for real. Because if he believes that there's voices and if he's hearing voices and he believes he's this prophet or whatever, maybe it has a different voice and it's almost like a different personality kind of thing. And maybe he imagined that he was getting calls himself or he just made that up and then he was making those calls to Patrick.
I don't ever want to like shit on someone's mental state or disability because if it's true, you feel like a complete jerk and you do the insanity defense sticks. But I don't know in this one. I feel like this was manufactured, but who am I? Hmm. So let's shift gears a second and talk about some of the inconsistencies in Dotson's story because one of the big things is when authorities were at the scene, they found a 32 caliber handgun there, which was Patrick's. That was the one that he bought. But they also found several live rounds that came from a box of 32 caliber ammunition scattered around the gun. And there was no sign that the 32 had been fired. And if you remember, Dotson was like, yeah, he fired it and it didn't go off or whatever. So there would at least be evidence of that. And they did find shell casings, though, from a 9mm, which is what he had in his hand. So right there, things are a little off track.
What a liar.
Things come out eventually in trial, and new information surfaces about Carlton's mental state and his connection with Patrick, and it revealed some kind of unsettling actions and potential reasons behind them. But, you know, was it all planned out? Was it premeditated, or did it just kind of go off the rails that day?
I don't know, but when I was like kind of like looking at the case, it seemed like a lot of people think that Baylor University didn't just sit back during the murder, but like actually tried to hide the truth to like save face for their basketball program, which again wouldn't surprise me in the least because it's all about the money.
Always follow the money in any any case. So Baylor's head coach Dave Bliss was already facing criticism for these NCAA violations and how he managed the team. And following Dennehy's death, Bliss attempted to create a narrative about Dennehy using drugs to shift the focus away from this ongoing scandal at Baylor. And it's freaking awful.
Oh my God, what a piece of shit. Like, you're a grown-ass man and you're making shit up about a kid. Bliss is a festering pustule, and shame on these universities for continuing to employ his shady ass.
And it was about a good kid, too. It was about freaking Patrick Dennehy. Yeah. Like, you know, it's awful. It's absolutely awful.
You're lower than scum when you're talking shit. Like, you're making shit up about a victim.
Yep. It's absolutely true. And Abar Rao, so we're going to get to our MU MVP, which has been dormant. Abar Rouse, that former assistant coach, he recorded a conversation. It was a phone call with Bliss in which Bliss directed his staff to misrepresent the details surrounding Patrick's death. And he also recruited three players, Harvey Thomas, R.T. Gwynn, and Ellis Kidd, to support this false narrative. And in the recordings, Bliss was heard telling the players to claim that Patrick was a drug dealer when speaking with Baylor investigators. He even mentioned that discussing the matter with McLennan County Sheriff's Department would allow him to practice his story. And Bliss aimed to portray Patrick as this drug dealer in an effort to safeguard his own reputation and the reputation of that prestigious university.
There's nobody right now that can say that we paid Patrick until he's dead. Okay? So what we have to do is create the reasonable doubt. I got like 30 years, I've never talked to an NCAA guy. Okay, so, I mean, that stands for something.
Yes.
And the thing about it is what the lawyers want to do is all they got to handle is $2,000 for the down payment.
Yes.
And then, $7,000 on the commission. What we got to create here?
Drugs.
And this one time I went out there, okay?
Okay.
This is like the middle of May. And we're up there and we're getting ready to do some shit. And Pat walks in with a tray. All of a sudden on this tray, I noticed some new shit. Okay, and that pills was like all kinds of wild shit. And put the tray down, okay?
Yeah.
When he put the tray down, and Patrick said something like, we're going to have some fun tonight. And we're going to let the other guys pay for it. And he brings out his roll of $100 bills.
On board?
Harvey will throw himself around like a grenade.
Okay.
Fucker alive when the truth sees him.
Okay.
Yeah, the hardest question. And the reason is because we did it for Harvey.
I'm with you.
You know, I mean, we stuck up for, that's why we're in this jam. If we stuck up for Harvey,
yeah.
Okay. I said there's no threats.
Yeah.
And all those people got pissed at me.
He didn't give a shit about the university. He gave a shit about himself and his paycheck. This is ridiculous. I'm so hype. It's, oh my God.
You know, but it's a game that generates literal millions for this university. So scandals happen all the time because of it. And the news of this phone call hit the nation hard, and it raised serious questions about how far Baylor had gone to hide the truth, which ultimately triggered a humongous NCAA investigation. And Bliss ultimately resigned, and the NCAA intervened. However, the harm to Patrick's legacy in the university standing had already occurred.
The only legacy that should be shit on is Bliss's.
This guy is still walking around, and it drives me up a wall. This scandal rocked the university, and it left it in shambles, literal shambles. We saw investigations into Baylor's culture, especially the lack of oversight surrounding the basketball program, and further leaving the community to deal with the deep emotional fallout. Carlton Dotson was eventually found guilty and sentenced to 35 years in prison, but the reasons behind the murder are still up for debate. And I hope you're ready, because he's out already. He got out a year ago. He got out a year ago. What's today? The 17th? We're recording on the 17th of March. He got out on the 24th. I want to say 24th or 25th of 2024 after he participated in some program, some early release program, and he's out.
Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure he's rehabilitated. Okay.
Yeah. Well, he has never spoken. He's never given a motive, which I know just from talking to his family, it eats them alive. And I know there's more to this story, and so do they. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like, did Carlton actually commit this crime to begin with? Was Coach Bliss involved in recruiting, like, hitmen, essentially, to take care of Patrick? And that, which was covering up his own wrongdoings and protect this university and all the boosters? I mean, to think about it, we're talking about a prestigious university that has power, there's greed, there's a long history of influential alumni with doctors, lawyers, judges, who might go to great lengths to safeguard Baylor University's reputation. And if you ask me, this university let Patrick Dennehy down. And it not only did they let him down, it cost him his life. And the people that were impacted by this, endless.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy had so much potential. And he lost his life for what?
Nothing.
So right after Patrick's body was found, Bliss started spreading rumors about him being a drug dealer. And this situation left a hole that can never be filled, especially for his family. Like, you go online and you look up stories, you will find Patrick Dennehy connected to being called a drug dealer. And it's shocking how little compassion there was, especially since Bliss is still coaching. While Abar got blackballed for doing the right thing, and Bliss only faced a 10-year coaching ban from the NCAA, and then he landed a job at Southwestern Christian University.
Shut up.
Never faced charges, never sanctioned, and never held accountable.
Well, you know what? Southern, whatever, Christian University, thou shalt not be a douche. You're breaking that one.
That's not a commandment.
Should be.
And so on a lighter note, I want to take a minute to celebrate the life that Patrick Dennehy lived and the love that he received from his family and friends. And we cannot forget the relentless efforts of those in authority who sought justice. And a special shout out to Abar Rouse for his incredible strength and bravery in standing up for what's right. Because just being a good person isn't enough if you don't speak out against injustice. And it really highlights his character and values. Like, I think the world of this guy, and I don't even know him. I'm just reading about the little character he played in this bigger story. But I, this guy's awesome. And it's heartbreaking for a family that has to cope without a brother and a son. And every day they're faced with this emptiness of just moving forward without Patrick in their lives. He truly was one of the nicest people you could ever meet. And I didn't know him, but from speaking with his relatives, I feel like I did. And there was not a bad word said about this guy. I mean, he looked out for everybody, especially his sister. And each day is a conscious choice for the family to seek peace. And you can't bury injustice. It will come to light and until the truth comes out. And I hope that one day it does, because I really do feel like there were more people involved in this case. I think that Carlton mm-hmm. Dotson was not the only one. I think Patrick Dennehy was 6'9". You don't just move someone around the desert like this. And like, I don't, you know what I mean? I don't think you can do this by yourself. So that is the incredibly tragic case of Patrick Dennehy, the wannabe NBA star whose life was taken by Carlton Dotson in part of what I believe is a massive cover-up on the part of Baylor University. But you are going to hear the impact that it had on the Dennehy family. Because if you guys noticed, there just so happens to be a bonus episode that dropped today as well, with it, which is an interview with Patrick's mother and sister, Valerie and Wynn Brabazon. And man, they had trouble holding it together, and we did too. Candace, who filled in for you for that interview, was on the verge. I mean, they really don't have a bad thing to say about Patrick. This kid had it This kid had his head on straight.
The stories they told about him were great. Like, I've watched a few pieces of the interview, and there's just so much love. And he just seemed like such a great kid. This is such a sad case.
Yeah, like, it really is.
And you've really managed to piss me off with this fucking coach. Oof. He'll get his.
Yeah, how are we, like, how are we not as a, I'm just pissed off at the university, and I'm like, the perpetrator, a murderer, is like an afterthought. That says something about how egregious all of this is.
It's so true. And shame on that university for hiring him with your Christian values. But moving on.
Yeah, Southwestern Christian University. Oh, stand by. Oh. So on April 3rd, 2017, in an article on Larry Brown Sports, Dave Bliss resigns from job at Southwestern Christian following documentary. I knew that a documentary had come out about this case, and it seems like that triggered Dave Bliss to just say, you know what? I need to probably step down. So good. He is no longer, it seems to me like he's no longer coaching. And he should not be lit near any children, any youth, any basketball program, any college, anywhere ever again. Screw that guy.
Unless people are throwing basketballs at his stupid head.
Good. Well, I'd be fine with that. I'm really glad about this. Anyway.
Yeah, seriously. That guy's an asshole. Well, thank you for telling this case, even though that makes me a little bit happier. At least he's not there, but he's still walking free, which seems like such a travesty and an injustice.
Yep.
Well, I guess that's all we have for today. But seriously, don't miss the interview. It should be in your feeds right now so you can stop listening to us and start listening to that. Although I'm not there, so it'll be so sad.
Candace was great, though. You know what? It was a good... I like the fact that Candace... So I should mention that one of our research producers, Candace Johnson, helped put this case together, and she became so invested in it because she remembers seeing the case when it broke, and there's some really cool personal connections to it. And she felt like such a bond to Patrick that it was like, man, let's let her do an interview too. It's her first one of her career. So, I mean, I think that it was a good learning experience for her, and she got to kind of see the last step of a case that she worked. So it was a kind of a big moment for her.
I'm really glad I got to pass the mic on for an episode.
Yeah, and I'll link it at the end of the show. There'll be a link to, like, when you get to the end of this one, you can click on it and go to the next if you want to see the interview.
All right, well, don't miss out on that. And don't miss out, because we're going to be starting a new block next week. April, we are doing spring cleaning, and we are cleaning out our inbox, and we are taking your suggestions. We went through our emails. We had a bunch of cases that people had sent in. We were saving them in a little folder. Now we're going through that folder, and we have some really good ones. I'm having a hard time picking.
There's a bunch. We have a cool interview, so we basically have four cases that we want to pull from the listener suggestions, and I think we found some good ones.
This might be one of those ones where I can't decide, so I do like a million, and you just get stuck editing all of them. So
great. Awesome.
But anyway, you don't want to miss those episodes. So make sure you like, subscribe. If you could rate and review, we would appreciate you forever. And let us know what you think about this episode and what you think about this case. We'd love to hear your thoughts, theories, opinions. So feel free to reach out to us on social media. We are at Murder Unscripted. On email, we are murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com. Or you can hit us up through our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com. So that is it for Ed and I. Be nice, be safe, don't bribe people to be on your team, and always remember, perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts. They wear coaches' jerseys.
I had to say that at the end of the interview instead of you, and I couldn't get Candace to say something snarky.
Oh, man.
What are you going to do?
Bye.